Hi, Bobby here. And this week's episode is a little bit different while we do some magic behind the scenes to revamp the format of the show. It is not massively changing, but there were some things that I was keen to tweak. And so we'll be back with a totally new episode next week with a guest that I'm very excited about. The numbers seem to suggest you guys are a big fan of them as well. So I'm looking forward to the reception for this one. It's a guest that I trust to try out a few new things with us. And whilst I'm not going to give all the spoilers away now, a few just off the top to reference is that inspired by so many wonderful messages that I received from you, the listeners, I will now be solo hosting the podcast going forward. Now, you might have seen this coming. You certainly seen it coming if you sent me a lovely email suggesting that I can indeed host it by myself and I'm doing just fine, because you know how weird it was in that sort of limbo space of not knowing when Danny would come back and doing so many intros on my own, talking like this to the mic in my kitchen on my own. And I would often rope Pete, our wonderful producer, in to be like, can you just listen to me talk? And he's like, yeah, can I like stand in the garden, have a cigarette? I'm like, yeah, just so something to make me feel like I'm not just speaking to a wall. And you know what? I think I am getting more comfortable with it. I'm still going to maybe make cheesy jokes to myself to help keep my voice light while we're doing these. But I do feel like I'm getting into the rhythm, and there's something refreshingly intimate about getting to really converse with you guys directly, even though I am fully aware that this is, whilst I get loads of nice messages, this part is a one-sided conversation. And so, yeah, I appreciate your feedback on that. If you missed some of the background on why Danny was unable to return to the show, you can listen to episode 239, which is also her favourite episode of the podcast that we re-released especially. And so, yeah, we're still very much in each other's lives. But I'm now excited to explore this new chapter. And I think if you've been listening for a while, you already know how much my confidence in podcasting has grown over these last 4 years. So it is exciting to feel that I am really embraced for the mission that we have here for the show, for the campaigning that we've done, for the petition that still continues to impact the lives of young people positively every day. And yeah, I didn't think I'd be getting emotional in this intro, but here we are. So thank you if you're a long-time listener. If you're a new listener, today's episode is actually kind of ideal, so well-timed picking it up, because today we have a selection of clips that I submitted to the Irish Podcast Awards, and it would mean the world to me if we were to win one or even be nominated. It's such an exciting awards in its first year, and I'm lucky enough to be one of the judges. Although, caveat, I will not be judging the categories I'm entering into. Conflicts of interest are fully considered. And it's going to be a great fun time. I love getting to be in the podcasting industry as much as possible. And the head of judges is Angela Scanlon, so I'll also get to meet her. So that's a lot of fun. Oh, the other thing to mention as well, last thing, is that another new change you'll see for the episode next week and episodes going forward is that we are rolling out extended episodes in the form of having after-interview debriefs with the guests, similar to what we do on Dating Games. And this is something that I've wanted to add to the show for some time, but there was just a bit of head-scratching behind the scenes to figure out exactly the kind of format and approach for that. Because on one hand, the guests often do say such fascinating and illuminating things when they reflect on the interview after we stop recording and give certain insights about maybe something they've said in the episode. It's the first time they've ever shared that with anyone, or they have an extra thought on something they said previously that they kind of want to challenge or adjust, and you get to just really understand that person to a whole different level. And that's something that I really wanted to share with you, whilst also respecting that I still have an off-air debrief to check in about, you know, were there any bits that they regret saying that they want us to edit around. How are they feeling going out of the episode? You know, just sometimes things need talking through a little bit more. And so just the same as dating games, that will be an exclusive for our Apple Podcast subscribers, that you will get that extended episode. But the regular length episode will still have the full usual interview there as well. So that's an option if you want to get extra content and support our work even more. And I'm excited to bring you even more really cool guests. We've got, I mean, in the next few weeks, wow, like some of these interviews, I really do think are a few of the best that we've ever done. If I can say that, I think so. We always have to see the listener response to truly know, but I'm feeling really privileged to have some of these conversations. So with that all said, I think that's enough spoilers for now. Oh, new artwork is coming. All right, now no more spoilers. The artwork won't be next week, but it is coming soon. So please enjoy this selection of clips from the show. I will include in the episode description which episode they're from. But for now, thank you so much. And first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out. This week, I'm delighted to be welcoming back my favourite sponsor, and I might get in trouble for saying that. However, to give you some of the history, the sponsor is Wild Deodorant. We were the first podcast they ever sponsored, and I so appreciate not just that initial support of what we do, but also that they keep coming back. This is their fourth time collaborating with us, and I am genuinely thrilled to talk about these products every time. Wild is now the UK's number one natural deodorant company and is rapidly gaining pace here in Ireland as well. And what sets them apart is they have refillable aluminum cases, which last you a lifetime, into which you slot a really brilliant range of scents. And you can mix and match. I actually have two of the cases, so I can swap day to day which scent I'm feeling more. And the formula that's used across all of them does not contain any of the nasties that can come in a lot of deodorants that are not natural. Instead, the approach Wild take is no harsh chemicals, no trying to change what your body naturally does. Instead, neutralizing body odor super effectively, making you smell of, for example, orange and neroli, fresh cotton and sea salt. I'm also using a charcoal limited edition scent at the moment, which is so good, and I would not have known what a charcoal deodorant would smell like until I tried this, and I was really not disappointed. So if you're ready to try a natural deodorant that really works, you don't just have to take my word for it. There's over 9,000 five-star reviews on Trustpilot. I have gone and read them because I had to know, am I the only person that is this obsessed with this brand? Turns out no, I'm really not. And so if you are ready to give Wild a try yourself, you can get an exclusive 20% off as one of our listeners. Just go to wearewild.com and use the code MENTAL2022 at checkout. You'll get free shipping in the UK and an 100% satisfaction guarantee. So that's wearewild.com with the code MENTAL2022. So get wild for a deodorant you'll really want to talk about this summer.
Was a bitter sweet year. January of 2018 is when I started feeling the symptoms of depression. But at the same time, I was in a sweet place because I'm in Coachella rehearsals with Beyonce and Kelly. Like, so I knew those hours in the day, it was going to be amazing. But when I would go home, it was sitting in that pit. I get engaged and I'm like, gosh, I got to tell him what's really going on. But he's already proposed. I've already said yes. Gosh. But that's what putting on that mask. People thinking everything's okay. Maybe we would have taken things a little slower. So by the time July 2018 hits, I can't take it anymore. I'm deep in that pit. It's so dark. And I'm like, all right, I'm not feeling safe with myself. And I'm a homebody, so I like being home by myself. So when I'm not feeling safe with just me, I knew, like I said the three words that changed my life. I need help. I can't do this on my own. I'm trying to function. I'm trying to cope. I'm trying to use the tools. And I wasn't in therapy consistently because what I was doing was I was waiting until something was wrong. And then I felt like, here I go, I'm calling a therapist when something is wrong. So I didn't even reach out. I stopped reaching out, you know, because it's like, you got to apply the tools that they're giving you. Why are you paying all that money? So you can't tell me nothing now. Since the end of 2018 to now, it's fitness, faith, and therapy. Mm-hmm. That's what's keeping me going. And it's been consistent. It's been consistent. Like I said, I don't care if I don't have nothing to talk about with my therapist. For the past few months, sometimes we just talk about what we ate last night.
I then began to worry about the fact that I was called a worrier. So I'm a very organized person, but as a child, I was always very organized. And I thought maybe this is a good thing because it means that I'm tuned into everything. I felt if I worry about things and think about things, well, then it means bad things won't happen. Like the bad thing won't happen. I used to always think if I think about the worst case scenario, well, then anything other than that is always good. But I remember at that age feeling kind of, it made me feel far more mature at the time because I thought, oh, I'm the worrier of the family. Like I'm the mature one. I'm, you know, I'll worry for everyone and I'll do everything for everyone. So definitely it made me feel quite mature for my age at 8 years old, really. So yeah, no, it is. It definitely is. It's seen as an endearing quality, you know, but I wouldn't say it's the most endearing, like, because a child, in my opinion, should always be very carefree and just enjoying their youth and being a young kid. Like, I know for a fact if I could have that time back again, that's all I would want to be doing, was just having fun. Because once you hit teenage years and adulthood, well, then there is a lot of objective worries. So I started to think maybe that this is a bad thing because my brothers aren't like this. And I took things on very heavy. Like, if someone made a bad comment to me in school or something, like that would throw me off balance for a few weeks and trying to deal with that. So I definitely think I resorted to food as a way to, I suppose, numb those feelings somewhat.
There's something that I think is super relevant to my relationship with mental health and race. So I'm just going to tell you a little story about when I was at school. So I grew up in a farming village, essentially, and I went to a school where there were very few people of colour. 4 years old, I started school a couple of weeks after I'd moved to the area. And I remember thinking that I was kind of excited to be starting school. I had no awareness, aged four, that I was different, let's say. I wasn't aware of that. I just thought, you know, I was a little girl like all the other little girls. And at break time, another little girl came over to me and she said, "Oh, hello, are you the new black family?" And I didn't know the answer to that question because I was 4 years old and I wasn't aware that I was the new black family, right? And so my relationship with my race started out as a really confusing one. And as I moved through school, there were more and more of these moments where other people would make observations about me and my race and what that meant. And I think I felt as I grew up that it was really hard for me to define who I was. And as I turned into a teen, I started to experience struggles with my mental health, but I'd never connected that to my relationship with race. I started to experience depression and like this intense need to isolate myself from people. And I still have this today, actually. Some days I just find it way too much to even consider going outside. Like the world for me is somewhere that feels like I'm gonna receive a lot of scrutiny. And often I just don't want to deal with that. I remember meeting my therapist and sort of saying, "These are my issues, this is what I struggle with." And she said that she'd never met somebody who experienced psychosis who hadn't experienced trauma. And I said, you know, I agree with that in principle, but the trouble is I'm not traumatized. Where's the trauma? And I think that now it seems so ridiculous that the thing that is traumatic is the thing that's most noticeable about me. It's the thing that people spot about me right away. It's the thing that that little girl noticed about me when we were 4 years old. And I'm only just starting to understand the impact that that's had on my life and the impact that that's had on my mental health, really.
I'm here to talk about 9/11, and I guess the best place to start is that morning. It was an unusual day for us. Shelley's portion of the Pentagon was actually being remodeled, or it was scheduled to be remodeled. And so she was going to have to stay late that night because she was in charge of the move. So we ended up taking two different cars. I got the kids, and that was a lot of fun because Drake was 3 years old and Chandler was almost 2 years old. So they were old enough to be very active in the back seat and require a lot of attention while I was driving. So got them to the daycare at the Pentagon. They were actually in the Pentagon daycare, which was just outside the building. And I remember pretty much my last image of Shelley is the kids, I was carrying them into the daycare. They saw her down the hall. They squirmed out of my arms and ran down the hall to her yelling, "Mommy, Mommy, Mommy." And she just reached down and scooped them up and gave them hugs and kisses. And so that's, you know, a great way to remember her. We went out to the parking lot after that, after we dropped the kids off. And I remember she had just put on lipstick, so she gave me an air kiss. And that was the last time I saw her. I went to my office, which was about 2 miles away, and got to work. And then had a phone call from her at about 9 o'clock. And she wanted to compare notes on the World Trade Center, because the plane had hit the World Trade Center at that point. And we were all trying to find information. At the time, we both worked for the Defense Intelligence Agency. She was in the budget office and I was doing counter drug work for them. But I was an intelligence analyst. I wanted to figure out what was going on. So I kind of rushed her off the phone, and I'll always regret that. About 20, 25 minutes later is when the plane hit the building. A friend of mine, a coworker who was homesick and lived near the Pentagon, called the office and told me that somebody had bombed the Pentagon. And that was the first I knew of it. And at that point, I just said, "I have to go." And he said, "Oh, that's right." I jumped in the car. I drove through. It was a place called Crystal City, just south of the Pentagon. Tall office buildings and hotels. So I think the building muffled the sound. And people didn't know why I was speeding, doing 55 or 60 in a 25-mile-an-hour zone. But I was driving as quickly as I could to the daycare. I got there and the kids weren't there. They'd been evacuated. So I went to go look for them. And I remember finding them was just probably the happiest moment of my life, just picking them up and holding them. And then I realized that Shelley wasn't there. And it became the worst moment of my life, because I knew that if there was any way for her to be to those kids, she would be. So I borrowed a cell phone. We didn't all have cell phones or smartphones at the time. I borrowed a cell phone and called her parents, who lived nearby. And I said, "I'm bringing the kids to you. I need to go look for Shelley in the Pentagon." And I remember her father said, "You can't do that, Don. We're going on vacation." He had no idea that the Pentagon had been hit. So I had to tell him. So we met at a gas station about halfway in between. And I remember telling him, "This doesn't look good, because the smoke is coming from where the helipad is. And that's very close to Shelley's office." So I went back and began an odyssey around the Pentagon. There was a big wall between the daycare and the Pentagon, so I couldn't just go directly to the site. I actually had to walk all the way around the Pentagon. And along the way, I remember seeing a triage center where they had brought people out, and they were all wrapped up in blankets and things like that. And I remember thinking, I'd know if she was there. I would feel it. And I didn't feel it, so I kept on walking. And then I remember there was another image that actually, the only time I've had a flashback was of this image of, there were about, 20 airmen in camouflage, and they were all standing in a row. And there were four of them across and about five deep, and each one had his hand on the fella in front of him's shoulder, and then on the shoulder of the man next to him. And they ducked their heads, and they jogged slowly into the building to go look for people. And you know, that one of the things that was comforting to me was seeing that, and seeing the firefighters later in the day. Nobody could have done more to help those people who were in there. You know, I can't sit there and say I could have done it better. I don't think I could have. I mean, like I said, and that did bring a degree of comfort.
There's hardly a time I go and talk about my mental health on stage where someone doesn't come up after me and say, "Ooh, me too." And to just not feel alone in it is so beautiful. And I use comedy just to start a conversation. Like, I'm not a mental health expert. I just have a mental illness, and I lost one of my best friends to something similar. And so I know what it feels like to lose people from it. And that's what I talk about. I know what it feels like to experience it myself and how maddening it can be. So that's why I talk about it. I think comedy just gives me the entrance and the door to be able to. Otherwise, it'd be very weird if I just went up to restaurants and started doing this, you know? It'd be very odd, especially in America. I think it would be imprisoned quickly. But comedy, you get the ticket to say, like, the best way I've heard a comedian described is you're someone on the debate team that someone actually wants to talk to. So you have an opinion, you have this view on life that you're ready to share, but you can only share it if it's funny. And so it's a real challenge to be able to do all of things, but I like that challenge because sometimes just someone going to be sad on a stage isn't going to help another sad person. They've got to feel the hope there. And there's something about laughing at it that just gives you a little hope.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.